Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, "And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching." I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
So, I was thinking.
No, you weren't.
I did once. It was earlier today.
I'll give it to you.
Okay. So, yeah, I was thinking, and
you were thinking about, let me guess, Cinnamon Toast.
I actually was not thinking, well, now I am, because now you put the thought into my head. No, I was thinking about how our brains are different from computers, and we've talked about artificial intelligence multiple times, and we've kind of alluded to that, but that we really wanted to go into a deeper look at the differences between the way computers process information, the way our brains process information, and to really kind of dig down into that.
You know, when you listen to some futurists talk about the singularity and the merging of mind and machine, one thing you often get the feeling of is that they sort of think of the brain as a computer.
Yeah.
The brain is a computer, and if you can basically just get them synced up right, they're
right.
Good to go.
Right. And it's a really sexy thought, especially since many futurists have backgrounds in computer science. And so it's kind of like, oh, yeah, obviously, this is a great metaphor.
Well,
it's going to work out good for all of us.
Especially if they're thinking about, like, with just the right amount of computing power, we'd be able to port our brains over into computers and then achieve digital immortality. You know, that's one of the many ways people have envisioned a kind of singularity event.
Another thing that ties into that is, sometimes they compare the power of a brain and the power of a computer as if they're both basically just like scaling up this same chart with the same value. You know, it's just a number,
right?
And a computer is higher or lower or something like that. But really, a brain and a computer, though they do some of the same things, are in other ways fundamentally different.
Sure. It's like saying, you know, if I'm able to lift a certain amount of weight and a machine were able to lift 10 times that weight, that machine is 10 times stronger than I am. That's a pretty simple comparison. But if you then try and convert that over into the ability to process and understand and learn and adapt, you know, that's totally different. It's fundamentally different, like you said,
yeah.
The way a brain and a computer work.
Using your analogy, be kind of like, well, yeah, okay, so the machine can lift more weight than you, but you have hands.
Yeah.
So maybe you could pick up a heavy but delicate thing that the computer couldn't pick up without puncturing.
Or that you could realize that that thing is a cat without having to be taught over the process of many, many weeks what a cat looks like.
And that ties into what we're going to be talking about in this episode.
Yeah.
So I think we should start by looking at some of the big high-profile computers people have seen as the really smart ones, the kinds that compete with human intelligence in a very recognizable way, like Deep Blue.
So Deep Blue, this is an IBM computer that was designed specifically to compete in chess tournaments. So this was one of those things where various computer scientists had been predicting that a computer would be able to beat an expert at chess eventually, given enough processing power, really. And Deep Blue was the first one to really achieve that. It was able to beat a world chess champion, Garry Kasparov, specifically. It was the second of the great Deep Blue Kasparov matchups. The first one did not go in Deep Blue's favor, but IBM kind of revisited it, did some adjustments. There was a second tournament. It was a best of six games, which I guess if you really think about it, there could have been a complete draw there. But in fact, Deep Blue won two matches against Kasparov's one match, and then they drew in the remaining matches. So Deep Blue came out the overall winner. Immediately, IBM retired Deep Blue because they said that was exactly what they set out to achieve, was to make a computer that could compete at a world chess champion level. And
straight from the after party to the burner.
Yeah, exactly. Like you're just
the incinerator. Yeah,
right. I
please
think actually
deposit chess master computer into incinerator slot.
Well, I'm not going to say they destroyed it. They just retired it.
Right.
The cake is a lie.
Anyway, this particular computer was able to analyze 200 million moves per second, or 50 billion possible positions within the 3-minute time limit that chess players get per turn. So
that's kind of interesting because obviously I am not a chess grandmaster, and I don't know all that much about chess, but I would think to some extent chess has to be kind of intuitive, right? Like a very, very smart person could think many moves ahead.
Well, yeah.
But the very smart person cannot think 50 moves ahead, I'd bet.
Most chess champions would not be able to think nearly as far ahead. But the other thing to take into consideration is not just thinking ahead, but anticipating what the other moves are going to be. So, for example, I'm a terrible chess player. I love playing, but I, against anyone who's competent at chess, I am almost guaranteed to lose. And it's partly because my brain just does not work very well when it comes to planning out moves and anticipating what my opponent will do. I might anticipate what my opponent will do based upon my particular circumstances at that moment, but I don't necessarily consider, wait, when I make this move, it's going to change those circumstances, which then
will react to.
Exactly.
To which, right.
Yeah, and then they're all also thinking ahead, and they may be changing their plans dynamically as I make my moves. The computer was much more adept at looking at all the potential possibilities and picking the most advantageous choice out of all of them. Now, even so, humans are really unpredictable creatures, and there were other computer programs that didn't do nearly as well against human chess champions. Even after Deep Blue, it would take a while for that to really develop. And even people who are chess champions who look back on the Deep Blue Kasparov matches say that Kasparov was just kind of off his game on that particular tournament. Mm-hmm. And that if Kasparov had played just a little differently, he probably would have come out victorious. So it was even in this very specific instance where you've got a limited number. I mean, it's a huge number, but it's a limited number of moves you can make in any given situation. The computer was very, very good at it, better than the world chess champion. But that was a very specific use case for that.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, from a computer's point of view, chess is about probability and logic solving. And those are two things that computers do incredibly well.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, if you've got the space in your memory and the time to look, you know, at what was it, 200 million moves per second, it doesn't really require intelligence.
Right.
You just kind of have to crank the numbers.
Well, and again, even with Deep Blue and being so great at chess, if you put Deep Blue up against a human in a different type of game, it wouldn't have done as well. It wasn't designed to do that, right?
You mean if you put it in front of a checkers board, it would just violate the rules and get disqualified?
Or Connect Four, or yeah. any game.
It'd be really terrible at Twister.
Yeah, okay. But no, the point I'm trying to get at, you jokesters, is that these computers are really, really good at the specific applications they're meant for, but they aren't any good at anything outside of that.
Yeah.
Whereas a human could be good at lots of different stuff.
Yeah, programmatic behavior, and we'll talk more about that later. How about another one, sort of along the lines of Deep Blue, Watson?
Okay, so another IBM computer. A lot of IBM is going to be talked about in this particular episode, and the next episode we'll be doing.
Well,
so,
studies show they make computers.
They do. They've been doing that for a while, in fact. But Watson, of course, is the Jeopardy. Computer. It's doing a lot more than just
playing Jeopardy.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's no longer just resting on its laurels as Jeopardy champion.
Now, Watson wasn't just one computer.
No, this was a computer cluster. It's actually a cluster of 90 Linux-based servers.
Oof.
With a total of 2,880 processor cores. So it was built for parallel processing. That's something else we'll talk about with the human brain, about how the human brain works compared to, say, a computer, a classic computer model. So it's able to solve more in parallel, which was very useful when you had to do things like search all of the data banks for information that seemed to fit any particular clue in Jeopardy, and then assign a probability for how sure, quote unquote, is the computer that would be the right response to any given query. And if it met the threshold, it would give that response. If it didn't meet the threshold, Watson would stay conspicuously silent.
Now, from what I understand, Watson had some interesting intelligence in that it was even okay at parsing some of the wordplay, which is pretty impressive, though that was ultimately where it performed the weakest, right?
Yeah, Yeah. So a lot of, if you've ever watched Jeopardy, in case you haven't watched Jeopardy, some of the clues are in the form of puns or.
Yeah, there's a lot of.
Yeah, homonyms, things like that, where they'll give a clue that it requires you to think outside of just this is the quote unquote question. Or here's the answer. What is the question to that answer? And it may be that it involves a little trick. You have to think in a creative way. And Watson was okay at that. Not nearly as good as the human champions were. So any category that did depend on that, Watson had to work a little harder, I imagine, to come up with an answer.
Yeah, I'd probably think about it like Watson was really good at questions that you yourself could easily solve by Googling keywords.
Right.
Yeah. And when you think about this cluster, this 90 server cluster with 2,880 processor cores, 16 terabytes of memory, 4 terabytes of clustered storage, able to do 180,000 gigabytes per second processing power, and it edged out the Jeopardy champions. I mean, some would say it beat them fairly soundly, but even so, you're looking at, look at how much raw power was right there. And this was one that, you know, it's still outperformed Jeopardy champions in just this one way. Like perhaps on another day or another week, maybe the champions, the human champions, maybe they would have won against Watson, or, you know, they challenged Watson to some other game like hopscotch. It's only they win.
Although, to be fair, I couldn't have won against those Jeopardy champions. So,
well, my argument is invalidated.
Okay, I think we should break down computers and brains and start to think about them in terms of what each one does and how they do them differently. So we started off talking about the idea of using a computer as sort of an analogy to think about a brain. It's like, yeah, a brain is basically like a computer. Does that analogy hold?
No,
not at all.
And
no.
Why doesn't it hold?
Okay.
Well, I mean, there are some similarities, right?
Oh,
well,
sure.
In the sense that both can process information, sure. But the way that computers process information, the way our brains process information, in fact, saying brains, that's really pretty limited. The way our nervous systems process information is very different.
Well, both do use electrical signals to transmit that information.
That is true.
Yeah.
I mean, both are able to send messages via those electrical signals.
Yep.
Yeah.
Both.
They have input and output.
Right. Yeah. You can, they have memory and you can add to that memory.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's true.
Both require energy in order to do this work.
Yes.
True.
That's also very true.
Yeah. And both can be changed or modified.
Yeah. We can learn. We can make our brains stronger. We can suffer injury or illness that can affect the ability for our brains to work. And computers, you can change or modify those pretty easily. That's pretty much what they've been designed to do.
Okay, so actually at a bird's eye view, a brain is a lot like a computer,
yeah,
but it's when you zoom in.
That's when it really, the differences
show up. So let's start with electricity.
Sure.
So a computer has electrical on and off switches, and that's how it manages information. Now, I don't think we even really understand fully how a brain manages information, but what's basically going on when we're thinking?
All right, so you got neurons.
Yeah.
Those are your little brain cells, right? And your neurons, there are several different types of neurons. And what they do is they use electrochemical reactions. You've got these various ions that get released within the neuron, which changes the electrical potential of the cell membrane. This ends up creating another way of releasing some ions in a synapse. Synapse is where you have two nerve endings kind of, there's a gap. They're not actually touching one another. And you have a chemical message going between one to the other, and it propagates throughout the nervous system this way. It's very, very different from the way a computer works, where it's not an electrochemical response. There's nothing to do with any kind of ions there. It's strictly electricity using electrons going through transistors to process information. To represent numbers, really, to represent zeros and ones. So very, very different approach.
Yeah. Another thing would be that computer instructions are executed in binary code.
Right.
We understand the way information is encoded in a computer. How is information encoded in a brain?
Well,
that's a great question.
Yeah. So
science doesn't know yet.
Things like memories and stuff, we've seen that as people think of things, certain neural pathways pop up. And in fact, neural pathways may represent things like memories. Like this specific pathway represents this specific memory. However, every time you think back on that memory, that pathway may change in subtle ways, which one is another illustration of how memory is not an entirely reliable or infallible source of information. And two, suggests that we got to learn a lot more about the brain to really understand how it works, because certainly that is not the way a computer works with memory. It's a very different model. So, yeah, until we really understand more fully how the brain and neural pathways work, it's hard to really even, you know, describe it in any accurate terms. You're really just talking in generalities, the stuff that we've observed so far, but we don't fully understand.
Mm-hmm. It's also harder to upgrade a brain. I mean, you can't just add a second brain to yours. Or, you can't strengthen the neural connections.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, you can learn, you can read, you can do a lot of things that essentially nourish your brain. Good nourishment's also important, obviously.
Yes.
So
fat is good.
Yeah, you want some energy in there, but yeah, you can do stuff that will strengthen your brain, but it's not as simple as, you know, popping open the skull and sliding in another memory card.
We've got an interesting note here that says computers are great at multitasking and brains most of the time aren't. And I think that's basically true, but that might seem counterintuitive because we were just talking about how computers are far outstripped by brains in terms of parallel processing. Brains can have a lot of different things going on. You're making different connections while a computer executes one instruction at a time.
Really, it depends on how you're looking at multitasking. If you're talking about a cognitive approach, like you're actually thinking about things, like you are actively
engaged in
an activity or task, mm-hmm. or whatever, then we're terrible at multitasking.
And anyone who says that they're good at multitasking is probably lying to themselves and or to you.
Yes,
because
statistically improbable.
Right.
There's a very tiny number of human beings on this planet who are actually super taskers.
They're not trying to deceive you on purpose.
Oh,
they're
no,
just
no, no. It's
texting at the same time they're talking to you. And yeah. So they're not really.
No.
Yeah. So computers are very good at being able to run multiple programs at a time and continue those processes. But depending on the type of computer you have, are computers at work? Maybe not so much. But, you know, typical good computer, yes. But people are not good at that. So while we are able to do a lot of things in parallel, there are some things we're doing great with multitasking, but it's all the unconscious stuff, right? All the blinking of our eyes, the breathing, the heartbeats, the monitoring our body temperature, stuff that we don't have to think about. Our brains are fantastic at that kind of multitasking. But when it comes to actually stuff that we are thinking actively on, not so much.
Yeah, I'd suggest that computers are good at multitasking because computers are good at keeping tasks discrete.
Yeah.
So you have one application running and it sends an instruction to the processor and executes it and comes back with the result. And then maybe another one sends an instruction and it all happens so fast. It seems like everything's going on at the same time, but the processes are kept discrete. In your brain, it's hard to keep different activities discrete. They bleed over into each other.
Yeah.
If somebody's talking to you while you're taking notes on a sheet of paper, you'll end up writing down the words they're saying by accident.
Right, or if you're listening to
you have this confusion.
Listening to a lot of music with lyrics in it. Like, I can't do research and listen to songs with lyrics in them, or else it just starts to distract me while I'm trying to read. Even if I'm not actively listening, it does kind of creep in.
I can't even listen to something with a melody. I listen to, like, rain generators online.
Those are great.
They're the best.
I listen to the same melodies over and over again because I've got my music, my film score collection on, and it has the same three composers, and I swear they just use the same score repeatedly. But anyway.
One more thing we're going to touch on more later is that brains have the ability to repair and regenerate to a certain extent, which computers don't without outside intervention.
Yep. Now, you can, of course, suffer irreparable brain damage that could affect you.
In many different ways. But in general, low levels of brain damage can be quote-unquote repaired by the brain just finding a different neural pathway.
Sure. Yeah. You can reroute the way that you would normally do a task. Depending upon, this is very specific case to case, but computers can't do this in general. There are a lot of interesting research projects out there are working on ways of making transistors that can do this kind of thing, where they can reroute a process so that if there were physical damage done to a chip, it would be able to continue working. But this is not something that is naturally, quote unquote, naturally built into computers. It's something that, you know, people have had to innovate around, whereas it's just a component of who we are, as, you know, that's one of those things that brains can do.
Yeah. Okay. So how do machines actually work? If you want to look at the way a computer thinks and zoom way in, when it's worrying, it's got the little machine brain going in circles.
Yeah, right.
The hourglass is flipping.
Or the little pinwheel.
Yeah, the little wheel. What's happening there? The first thing I think we should talk about, I guess, is something called the von Neumann architecture.
Sure.
And that's, if you have a laptop sitting in front of you, it's almost definitely a von Neumann architecture machine.
You know, if it's not, then you're working for someone pretty cool.
Right.
Possibly the military.
And call us.
Yeah.
The vast majority of typical computers are von Neumann.
Yeah. So John von Neumann published papers in the 1940s about the requirements for a general purpose electronic computer. And those thoughts ended up becoming the architecture upon which we base computers today, most computers, I mean, the vast majority of computers. So he identified four main quote unquote organs for a general purpose computing machine, which were arithmetic, memory, control, and user interface. So ultimately, this boils down to what we think of as the CPU and memory, and plus some sort of user interface.
So but, input and output.
Well, not even input and output. You're talking about really the two input outputs, what you get from this. But
yeah.
CPU and RAM, those are the two elements that you need in order to make any sense of anything.
No, I was talking about the other elements.
Oh, right, right,
right. The control and
sure,
user
sure,
interface.
Sure. Yeah, control would be in that as well. Yeah. So CPU, your central processing unit, the job is to execute instructions. So essentially think of that as some sort of mathematical process. Yeah.
Increment this value by one.
Right.
Delete this value.
Multiply by whatever, you know, multiply by the closest prime number to that number, anything along those lines. And the instructions will change as whatever it is you're doing changes. Now, those instructions have to be executed upon something. It doesn't make sense to you for you to just say add. You need things to add stuff to. So that's where the RAM comes in, the random access memory. This is where the computer holds information that it is going to execute instructions upon. So
yeah.
You've got the instructions that you need, and then you've got the data that you need, and you do the two together, and that's where you get the computation.
Yeah, so in the memory, you might have slot A and slot B, and you could execute the instruction that says, multiply what's in slot A by what's in slot B and put the answer in slot C.
Yeah. And so anytime you're talking about any kind of input into a computer, let's say that you're just playing a video game. Every time you're taking an action in that video game, it's sending an instruction down to the processor. Ultimately, actually, it's sending lots of instructions. No single task is going to be just one instruction and then you're done. But it then takes in all the data that it needs. It executes the instructions in order. And then gives you the output, whatever the outcome is supposed to be. So when you press A, Mario jumps. I think it's A. B, I think, is run. Anyway, that's the basic idea here. And also an important thing to note is that this series means that you are processing information in sequence, right? It's not that you suddenly have a task and it just does everything all at once and everything gets completed. In your classic CPU-RAM relationship, you are executing instructions one after the other, which means that if you wanted a more powerful machine, you would have to get a faster processor, right? That's the only thing you can do because it can just process those instructions in a faster rate.
It's still one at a time. But
yeah,
right.
Still one at a time. Still doing like, okay, we got to do step one, step two, step three, step four, step five. It's not doing steps 1 through 1,000 all at the same time. It's doing these all in sequence. So in order to have a faster machine, you just have to make a microchip that can process stuff faster, which means that you need more energy, which also means you're going to be generating more heat. And here's where we start running into the problem with von Neumann architecture. It's that in order for you to scale it up to really, really, really high levels, you have to pour so much energy into it, and you get so much excess energy in the form of heat coming out of it. You're losing so much energy in the form of heat that it's no longer efficient. It's fine for the lower powered machines. And by lower powered, I'm talking about the stuff we tend to rely upon. But if you're talking about a truly powerful supercomputer, it doesn't quite measure up.
Now, there are plenty of computers that use some degree of parallel processing.
Sure.
Oh, sure. That's another way to squeeze a little bit of extra efficiency out of a system.
Yeah, yeah. You can have a processor with multiple cores, for example, and those cores, you use things like multi-threading architecture. Multi-threading means that you're able to divide up tasks so that each core of a processor can work on part of that task.
Yeah.
The way I usually describe this is imagine that you have a really smart math student, all right, like genius level math student, and then you have 8 math students who are above average. They're not geniuses, but they're good, and you give both of them problems. So you give first everyone gets the same math problem. And the genius, you would imagine, would finish that faster because the genius is just able to process this and to go through the whole series of questions or whatever really, really quickly. But then you give both of them a different questions. You give the genius a question that's like a multi-part problem, and each problem is independent of the other. So you don't have to solve one in order to know the answer for the second one. The group of 8, you give each person in that group of 8 one part of this multi-part problem that you've given the genius. Now, individually, those 8 people might be able to solve their smaller problem much faster than the genius is. And that's where this multi-core processing comes in. It works great for problems that can be divided up like that. If it can't be divided up, it's not terribly useful.
Sure.
So this is another thing that we talk about with the potential for quantum computing down the line, where you have massively parallel systems, which for some problems would be amazingly fast, like orders of magnitude faster than the fastest classical computer. For other problems, it would not be any better than your average classical computer.
Okay, so when looking at them compared to brains, what are computers really good at? I'd say they're really good at any pre-programmed rote processing at scale and speed.
Sure.
So a human brain will never be able to do something like arrange a correctly formatted data set according to a specific instruction as fast as a computer can. So imagine you've got like this huge unsorted list
Sure.
of number values, and you've got like 100,000 of them. And the task is we need to put these values in order from lowest to highest.
Mm-hmm.
So ascending order. You cannot possibly compete with a computer. Your human brain will just not do it. The computer can do that so much faster and better than you. It's hilarious.
Even if somehow you had some sort of savant-like ability to sort all those numbers instantaneously, or what would seem instantaneous to anyone else, you wouldn't be able to express it faster than a computer could.
Right.
So even if somehow your brain was able to keep up with it, you could not, at the very least, you couldn't express it. But yeah, I don't think there is a human, especially if you're talking about a list that's, you know, it doesn't matter how long it is if you've got a computer that's got a powerful enough processor. If you've got a list of 10,000 numbers and you sort it.
Even if it's a list of 10 numbers, the computer will do it much faster.
Yeah. Yeah.
Part of this rote processing thing also is that computers are way better at following rules consistently. You know, they don't get stuck on contextual information. Like, they're never in a bad mood and so therefore less effective, and or you know, they don't have a lack of caffeine or sleep that's messing up their processing, or they're not influenced by what else is going on around them.
Distracted by clicking on links to things, and then it's 4 in the morning and you've got 35 tabs open. You haven't sorted your list. But there's a variation on this same scenario where a human might be much better than a computer. So I want to say, imagine the same thing. You've got a list of 100,000 numerical values, and you need to sort them in ascending order. But the list is not just numerals. It consists of numerals and numbers that are spelled out, like 5, F-I-V-E, and the numbers are spelled out in 6 different languages. So you've got 5 and cinco and other stuff. And sometimes there are typos. So it'll be like flive, F-L-I-V-E, or clinko, you know, whatever it is. The computer is stuck unless it has been told how to deal with this kind of information, unless it's been given a backup system that tells it what to do when it hits an anomaly. It cannot complete this task. The human brain might take a long time, but you can do it.
Well, not only that, but you could also make this even more difficult for the computer by having visual representations of the number five that are not a numeral. So let's say you have a hand held up with five fingers spread. For a computer, how would it know that the number is five versus, say, one, as in one hand? I mean, it's, you know, this is one of those things where unless the computer is taught what that means,
then
it cannot count it. So, that in fact is one of the things brains are really good at. We're able to, with our brains, be able to learn a concept and not just that one instance of that concept, but be able to apply that across a more universal plane.
And recognize variations.
Yeah. Our brains are very adaptive. So I've said this before on this podcast, and I think I want to stick by it. Computers are really good at getting it right and doing it fast, but brains are better at making things work when there's trouble.
Well, here's another example, a very simple example. Let's say that I show you, Joe, a mug, and I tell you, this is a mug. And it's just a, you know, plain mug. It's maybe white in color. It's got nothing in it. It's empty. But then I show you a black mug.
What is that?
Yeah.
I've never seen anything like that.
Okay. For most normal humans, they would just say, okay, that's also a mug. That's just a black mug. But let's say I showed you another white mug that's similar to the first one, but it's twice as large.
Different shaped handle. Or you're showing it to me from a different angle.
Right. Or there's something inside it. Yeah. Or, I mean, there are all these different variations that, but once we learn a concept, we can apply that and recognize it when we encounter it again, even if it's not exactly the same shape, size, color.
Has a different witticism about Mondays on it.
Could be, yeah. whether there's Garfield or no Garfield. Maybe there's Heathcliff. Who knows? But you're able to recognize it for what it is. Whereas with a computer, it's a lot harder to do that. You might be able to set certain parameters with a computer and tell it this is what this thing is. But then if it encounters anything else that is that thing but is a different set of parameters, it could be totally stumped.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about then how does the brain work? Now, granted, again, the caveat that we don't really understand exactly how information is encoded in the brain or how the brain does information processing, but we have some ideas at a certain level what's going on when we're thinking.
And by we, Joe means humanity and science, not just the people sitting at this table.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, again, we're talking about those electrochemical signals, right? Specifically, you're talking about sodium and potassium ions within a nerve cell that's changing the membrane's electric potential. And then you've got the synapse, which is that little gap between two nerve cells they don't actually touch, where the exchange of chemicals happens, where it becomes this communication between different nerves. Our nervous system is made up of these nerves. These nerves are running all through us, right? We've got our central nervous system. We've got the brain and the spinal cord, but our nervous system is more than just that. And so it's pretty complex system. And again, we can't even fully explain what's going on. We know that there are certain regions of the brain that are responsible for specific functions. Like, you know, you say like the visual cortex, for example. We talk about these parts of the brain that we know are responsible, but we don't fully understand the mechanisms involved or the interrelation between all of them.
Well, we know that it doesn't happen like a computer where you have memory storage here and then processing here.
Yeah, Joe's holding his hands up, which is very useful for radio.
A value goes from memory storage to my other hand,
yeah,
where it gets processed, and then back to my left hand. I just thought I'd throw that in there.
And then it goes
to your foot,
yeah,
which is what people are looking at. That's the screen.
Okay.
No, it travels back and forth like that. What's going on in the brain? Well, we don't have knowledge of really discrete trade-offs like that.
Yeah.
Instead, what we have is a vastly interconnected system of cells that are all communicating back and forth with each other. When the brain is thinking, we've got these cells lighting up with electrical and chemical signals, action potentials, and they get traded off back and forth, and something's happening.
Yeah. In fact, there's a lot of debate in philosophy about what is going on. For a long time, the prevailing model was this idea, a dual model, where you had the mind and the body, right?
Yeah.
And so that the mind is totally separate from the body.
Exactly.
It's kind of immaterial.
The mind might be dependent upon the brain, but that would be about as far as they would go with that. Saying, okay, the brain, yes, sure. If you damage the brain, you damage the mind, so therefore there's some connection there. But they wouldn't go further beyond that. But there's also another philosophy, embodied cognition, which is really more about how the body is part of our nervous system to the point where a lot of our cognition is dependent upon our experience with our bodies. If we didn't have those bodies, we would not think the way we do. The reason we think the way we think is because of our physical forms, at least in some part. So it's interesting how this manifests in different ways. One of the popular ways that people have pointed out is through the development of our language and metaphors.
Oh, yeah, yeah. For example, if you're talking about affection or anger, you talk about it being warm.
Yeah.
And that, you know, is theorized that it could be because, you know, affection you get when you're a kid and someone hugs you and that's,
right.
that's a warm thing. And anger is a physiological response that mm-hmm. happens in your body that raises your body temperature.
Yeah, so, right. Or if you're feeling happy,
you're up.
And if you're feeling sad, you're down. You know, these are interesting ideas that, again, without the body, if the mind were totally separate, why would we have these different metaphors? Now, there are a lot of different arguments about how whether or not that actually indicates embodied cognition, but it is an interesting idea. And it does mean that, again, the way we think would be very different from computers.
I think a very interesting way of thinking about it is the classic quote from Marvin Minsky, who said, "The mind is what the brain does."
Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah.
It's a process that's being conducted by this organ.
Sure, sure. And, you know, I do want to put in there, I mean, like, you've got neurons all over your body. You know,
yeah.
you've got them in your fingers. And so it's really all brain.
It's
when you
really what binds us and penetrates us. And I'm sorry, I'm thinking of the Force.
It's similar.
Yeah. No, very similar. You know, it's the intrinsic component that allows us to think, even though we can't fully understand exactly what the process is. But what we do understand is that that's not how computers think. You know, that's
nope.
partly, you know, computers, nope. even if you were to say that a computer thinks, it processes information in a very linear, serialized way, if we're talking about von Neumann architecture at any rate.
Okay, well, now let's look at the flip side. Earlier we talked about how computers are much better than human brains at doing pre-programmed sort of arithmetic-based tasks or any kind of information processing that has correctly formatted data sets and needs to be done at scale really fast. What are human brains better at?
Well, they're definitely, brains are much more energy efficient.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So let's take a look. If you look at the K supercomputer, which is one of the most powerful supercomputers in the world, right? You're talking about a supercomputer that's pulling in about the equivalent energy that would power 10,000 homes.
Oof.
Yeah. Now, if our brains required that, we would never stop eating. Ever. And even then, we wouldn't be able to think very much.
I mean, so, I already never stop eating, so that's...
Right. The moral of the story is never stop eating and you'll be a genius.
Sources vary about the exact number of watts that it takes the human brain to run on, yeah?
Yeah. I've seen estimates in the range of 20 watts to 25 watts. I read a Scientific American article that estimated about 12.6 watts.
Yeah, we're talking about not a whole lot of juice here. I mean,
yeah, yeah. The number that I've seen given is that silicon computers take some 40,000 times more energy to run than the human brain does.
So even though these computers are better at certain tasks, they definitely are not better as far as efficiency goes. The brain is incredibly efficient. It's also, I mean, it's volumetric. It's a really dense processing power all by itself. But so that's one thing we can look at brains being better. Another thing is this whole idea about being able to learn.
Yeah, I mean, you've heard of the idea of a learning machine or a learning computer. The reason that phrase exists is because that's kind of a unique and ideal situation for a computer. Generally, computers don't learn. They are told what to do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They seem smart, but they're dumb.
Right.
Yeah.
No, they have no creativity or initiative or adaptivity. They're just very good at doing what they're told. So, unlike computers, brains have what's called neuroplasticity, which is the ability for a brain to change itself in response to injury or in a reaction to a new situation. So simple computers do not learn anything or change their behavior unless a programmer specifically instructs them to do it. They don't naturally make changes to themselves, and brains do. So what if you want a supercomputer that doesn't just do exactly what you tell it to do? what if you want to create an artificial general intelligence program that updates its behavior the way we do when we say we learn about something, we learn that something we were doing, maybe the way we talk is considered rude by someone in a way we didn't think about, and we update our brain with that new information and we just don't act that way anymore.
Or we act that way all the time, always.
Right. If you're Jonathan. Yes.
Yeah.
Or, and this is really helpful, what if you want a computer to help you solve a problem when you don't fully understand the nature of the problem or how to solve it? I mean, with simple computers, you're stuck there. They're very useful tools, but they're not going to help you define the boundaries of the problem you're trying to solve.
Right.
But a brain can do that, right? You can talk through a problem with a person, you can sort of figure out, oh no, here's what we're really talking about.
There's innovation with a brain.
Yeah.
Right. You can innovate as a person. If we couldn't, we would not be here talking into microphones, you know, recording a podcast right now. None of that would be possible. Whereas with computers, innovation's not something you would typically see from a computer. A computer would simply follow instructions. They'd do it really well, but not come up with new ways of coming at a problem with a classic von Neumann approach computer.
Right. Here's another one. So dealing with real world data, I mean like images and sounds and smells and stuff like that.
Things that you can touch, yeah.
Yeah. So computers are really good at dealing with, as we've said, correctly formatted abstract data, like numbers or strings of ASCII characters. But computers are not good at dealing with the kind of data we get through our senses. So we can force them to do it, but it's top heavy and it involves a lot of inefficiency and hand holding.
Sure.
So imagine a computer's trying to look at a human face and answer a question like, does this person have a mustache? Not that hard for humans to do, but for a computer, you could write a program to do this. I have no doubt that it would be possible to make a mustache detecting computer, but it would take a lot of work and it wouldn't be as efficient at the task as just a human would be. And so to do it, what would you need to do? You need to take a picture, convert that into digital data, like a bitmap image. Then you'd have to program the computer to recognize the different parts of the face in terms of the digital bitmap, and then account for differences in how the thing might look. So differences in hair color and skin color. And what if all the pictures aren't head on? And how do you keep it from thinking an eyebrow is not is a mustache? Huh.
And those kinds of patterns are very difficult to teach a computer the definitions of.
Yeah.
I would suggest that one way of going about it is to build in some GPS capabilities so that if it's in Brooklyn, it's already a 90% probability that yes.
Oh, Jonathan, your hipster jokes could only be produced by a human brain.
For that, we should all be thankful.
Okay. But seriously, I mean, so computers can do things like this, but brains are much better at them. They're much more efficient. And they have much more versatility in these
right.
kinds of tasks.
This is coming back to that whole idea about showing Joe the mug.
Yeah.
And then Joe is able to recognize a mug, whether the next mugs he encounters looks identical to the first one or different. He understands what a mug is.
Right. It's really hard to teach computers about context. And I know I said a minute ago that that's on the plus side of machines, you know, not getting distracted by stuff or confused about extra information, but really can go either way depending on what you're trying to do. You know, if you're trying to solve a logic problem, then removing the context can be really useful. Point machines. But if you're trying to react appropriately in a conversation, context is everything.
Sure.
Also, okay, we talked earlier about how computers are really good at doing things faster than human brains in many different contexts. But the brain is better at speed in a lot of other ways. You know, you can program a computer to do lots of difficult things given enough time and power. But for example, even a mouse cortex runs about 9,000 times faster than home computer simulations of a mouse cortex function.
Sure. So if you're trying to make a computer behave like a brain, it turns out that's really complicated to do, and the computer is not good at behaving like a brain, at least not on the scale that an actual biological creature is capable. It's going to use way more energy and take way more time.
Right, yeah. The state of the art in terms of speed is from that K supercomputer that we were talking about earlier. And In the beginning of 2014, it modeled 1 second of 1% of human brain activity in a mere 40 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, that's how complex we're talking about here. Granted, also that complexity stems from a large amount of us not knowing what the heck is going on the grand scheme of things. So if we were able to make a computer behave more like a brain, it'd be really interesting to see what that would computer would be capable of doing.
And that's what we're going to talk about in our very next podcast.
What? So, oh, yeah, look, right there in the notes.
Tune in next time to hear the follow-up to this discussion where we talk about how to make computers more like brains.
Yeah, and it's an interesting discussion. We'll even talk a little bit about why would you want to do that. So join us for that. Also, if you have any suggestions for future topics, then I highly recommend you get in touch with us and let us know about it. You can send us an email. Our address is fwthinking@discovery.com. Or you can drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook or Google+. Our handle at all three is fwthinking, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.